Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. When investment performance matters, make sure your savings are with Zurich. Visit zurich.ie to find out more.
To Kyiv first this evening, because Kira Rudik is a member of the Ukrainian parliament and head of the Honos party. She's currently in Kyiv and has been recording the devastation of the city by Russian bombardment. Her videos on social media show the destruction of streets and buildings in Kyiv. I spoke to her in the last few minutes, just before we came on air, and asked her to describe the situation there in Kyiv at the moment.
Today, we are off the curfew that we had for 35 hours. So I was able to go and examine the destroyed buildings. And I can tell you it's a terrible picture. The shelling on Kyiv continues. It's still heavy as it was. Russian tried to attack yesterday, but they only were getting to outskirts of the city and they were pushed back by our army. So right now the city is getting to the next round, I can tell you. We are getting to the food and water and supplies to make sure that we continue being ready for a potential siege. However, the most destructions, obviously, we're getting from the Air Force attacks, and there were four buildings destroyed during the last 2 days. I can tell you, it's just sounds, four buildings, but once I've been there on the spot, it's like hundreds of lives that are right now disrupted, destroyed, that will never be the same.
And I saw the video, Kira, that you posted on your Twitter account, of the destruction of those buildings, the rubble, the absolute razed to the ground, some of those buildings. Can you describe to me your reaction when you first saw the destruction?
So I was, you know, the first reaction is this cannot be real. It must be like some mistake. It just cannot, your mind cannot process it. It's just like, imagine any normal building, like five-story building with people's stuff in it. And then you're coming in and you're seeing that all the balconies are being destroyed and things are hanging around. And then you go there and you see that there is no wall in the building. And this is so humiliating for people because like they are like all the private stuff is just like thrown to the public and you cannot even feel safe anywhere. And then I saw a man standing near the car that was burned to the ground. There was just a shell of this car. And I asked him, like, do you live here? He said, yeah, I do, and this was my car. And I asked, like, are you okay? And he said, yeah, I'm fine. I'm just coming and standing here. Like, I'm trying to remember what I had inside it and, like, and why it happened. Why it happened like this. Mm-hmm. And he was so completely, he was broken. And this is not what I want for my people, to be broken because of Russian missiles are coming into our homes.
Yeah, broken, but incredible resilience and defense after 3 weeks of war in your country. The US President Joe Biden has spoken to the President of China, Xi Jinping, today. And there are fears within the European Union, Kira, that China may be getting ready to aid militarily Russia with their war effort. Is that a fear you have there?
Well, I could tell you, if Russia, that has the third largest army in the world, needs the support of another superpower like China to fight Ukrainian army, then I take it as a compliment, right? Russia thought that they will be able to take us just like with a blitzkrieg. But honestly, what I think is not the military support that we fear. We fear that China will be financially and economically supporting Russia. And the goal that all the democratic countries have right now is to make sure that Russia is just a huge new North Korea with no trade connections, with no economic relations, with default inside the country, and people who will at some point rebel against Putin. This is the goal, and China supporting Russia in this matter will make this goal harder to achieve.
Can I ask you if you hold much hope for the talks that are ongoing between Ukraine and Russia?
No, absolutely. So I don't see any good outcome of these talks. And I don't think that we should make any deals with Putin. So first, because what in the past makes us think that there could be a deal with Putin? There was no deal in before that he was acting on. He is known to break the deals. The second question is, if he breaks the deal, then what? Who is the guarantor? Who is the warrant for these negotiations? Who will make Putin execute on the deal? And if there is none, then there is no way, because he is just like a bank robber who is coming to you saying, I plan to rob you, and now give me your weapons first. And we are saying, like, no, we are going to fight you. And he said, maybe peaceful negotiations. We say, whoa, what kind of peaceful negotiations? So right now, Ukrainian people armed and ready to fight. And we are ready to fight till the end.
Okay.
And we understand definitely that Putin's goal is to destroy us. And there is nothing right now in the world. We don't see a power in the world except ourselves who will be opposing him on this mission to destroy us. And this is why we will be standing up to him.
Okay, and you have done so as a country for the last 3 weeks. Kira Rudik, we will speak again, I hope, very soon. But thank you very much indeed for the moment.
Well, Russia's invasion of Ukraine more than 3 weeks ago has put to the test the international system of diplomacy that was founded in the wake of World War II with the aim of preventing another global conflict. The West's response to this invasion was swift and has focused on economic sanctions and humanitarian aid. But what should the next move be? And does diplomacy still have a role to play? Well, we're joined now by former US ambassador to the Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer, who has spent more than 25 years with the US State Department and is also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. And Stephen, you're very welcome to the programme this evening. Thank you very much for joining us. We might go first to that news today that, well, we know that President Joe Biden has spoken by phone to his Chinese counterpart, to Chinese President Xi Jinping. We don't know yet from the American side how that phone call went, but we do know from Chinese state media apparently the state-to-state relations, according to Xi Jinping, cannot go to the state of military confrontation. Conflict and confrontation are not in the interest of anyone, he said. And he also said that peace and security are the most cherished treasures of the international community. What weight would you put on what he had to say?
Well, I think the big question is, will the Chinese actually do something? President Xi is probably the international leader who has the greatest influence with President Putin. Will he now use some of that influence to try to persuade Putin to stop this brutal and unnecessary war?
And what influence or what role could he play? What could he say to Russia that might convince Vladimir Putin to stop?
Well, he can use, you know, Putin sees his relationship with Xi as the most important relationship that he has personally with a foreign leader and that Russia has with any other country. If China begins to express concern about this and express weight, that could increase the pressure on Putin to begin to become more realistic about Russian demands for ending the war. Because what the Russians have offered so far looked to be pretty maximalist, asking for demilitarization. Putin still talks about denazification, which I think is his code word for deposing the current government, which of course is headed by a Jewish president. But he talks about recognition for the Russian annexation of Crimea and also for the independence of these two so-called people's republics. It's a pretty maximum list, which doesn't seem to offer much for the Ukrainians to work with.
In terms of China's role then, and that line that I read out from the Chinese media reporting that Xi Jinping said that peace and security are the most cherished treasures of the international community, would you see that as a signal to Russia from China that they're not supportive of the war? And is it a significant enough signal perhaps to make Putin think or stop?
Yeah. I think the Chinese are uncomfortable by the war. They're uncomfortable by what Russia's doing. And it may make Xi a little bit uncomfortable that he's personally tied so closely to Putin. Friends who follow this say in the last couple of days, they've seen the Chinese media moderate some in terms of its support for Russia and in terms of talking about what is actually happening in Ukraine. And it was interesting that the Chinese ambassador to Ukraine for the first time 2 days ago met public or in a publicized meeting with Ukrainian officials. Hopefully that means China's beginning to adopt its stance, but again, it has pressure that it can apply on Russia to try to bring this to a halt.
Okay, so while that's going on in one aspect of this whole situation, obviously what's happening on the ground in Ukraine, very difficult. We've been reporting on it in this program, particularly at the moment in Mariupol and the theatre there. And I see that the UK Chief of Defence Intelligence is saying this afternoon that he believes that Russia is now pursuing a strategy of attrition that's going to involve the reckless and indiscriminate use of firepower, which will result in increased civilian casualties and destruction of Ukrainian infrastructure. Would you agree with that assessment, that that's the way Russia is going now, a strategy of attrition?
Yeah, Sarah, I fear that that's true. It appears to me that the Russians made a huge miscalculation about the readiness of Ukrainians to defend themselves. So there was this very early attempt to capture Kyiv with a small number of forces, almost as if the Russians expected to be greeted as liberators, and they were repulsed. And now the Russians, you've seen over the last 3 weeks, as pretty much everybody says, the Russian military is way underperforming, that they're cranking up the use of violence. You've seen this with the brutal pounding of Mariupol over the last week, which ironically, Mariupol is a Russian-speaking city. Almost half the population there is ethnic Russian, and they're getting the brunt of the use of force by the Russian military. So I think what we're seeing is as the Russians become frustrated in Moscow, they're putting more pressure on the military to deliver results, and the military is resorting to much more indiscriminate use of artillery and surface-to-surface rockets and things like that, which are wreaking huge damage on Ukrainian cities.
We also have been discussing in the last couple of weeks the possibility of chemical weapons being deployed by Russia and a fear that they would indeed be used. Now, they haven't yet. Joe Biden, the US president, saying that if Russia was to use chemical weapons, that they would pay, there would be a severe price for that. But he didn't outline what that severe price would be. Realistically, in your view, what could or would the US do if there were chemical weapons used?
Well, first of all, let me say this, I think, is part of when the United States and the British government talk about this. What they're trying to do is basically make it difficult for the Russians to use chemical weapons and say, this is what the Ukrainians did. In the same way that they've used intelligence and they declassified intelligence to a far greater extent than in the past to basically foreshadow what Russia was going to do. I mean, if you look back at what the American intelligence people were saying in January, they pretty much called this invasion. So I think they're trying to basically make it more difficult for the Russians to create some kind of incident. And hopefully that will deter the Russians from doing it.
It might, but it didn't the last time when they said they were going to invade and they did invade. So if they were to use chemical weapons, do you think there is anything left that the US can do short of sending in troops or handing over some weapons to use?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would absolutely exclude that if the Russians use chemical weapons, the United States is not going to provide chemical weapons to Ukraine. I mean, the U.S. still has a small stock, which are being destroyed under the chemical weapons agreement. No, the president and NATO have drawn a very clear line that they will not send American or NATO forces into action against the Russians to defend Ukraine. But there are things that the West could do, and I think the West would respond. It would include even more sanctions. There are still some Russian banks that are allowed, for example, have not yet been cut off of the SWIFT system. There are many more people that could be sanctioned personally. And the West could send other conventional weapons to Ukraine. So I think the Russians have to take that into account, that there would be, I think, outrage in the West, and the West would do something. But it's probably smart that the West is not yet sort of specifying exactly what it would do.
Why? And when you're talking about sending other weapons to Ukraine, obviously one of the things that Ukraine have been asking for is the establishment of a new no-fly zone and also weapons to try and target aircraft flying over Ukraine. Would that be possible? Do you think that those could be sent in?
NATO's been pretty clear that it would not do a no-fly zone. And I think their rationale is correct. I mean, to my mind, a no-fly zone would be relatively marginal gain and great risk. The marginal gain is, while there are a horrific number of civilians who are being killed by Russian military action, the bulk of them are not being killed by air power. It's artillery and mortars and tanks and short-range surface-to-surface rockets, things that a no-fly zone could not stop. The risk would be that if you're going to do a no-fly zone, NATO would have to be prepared, first of all, to shoot down Russian airplanes, but also would have to be prepared to protect NATO planes over Ukraine, have to be prepared to strike air defense assets, not only with Russian forces invading in Ukraine, but also with Russian forces in Belarus or even Russian itself. And if you're doing that, that's pretty close to an all-out shooting war. So I think the no-fly zone is off the table. But as President Biden said a couple of days ago, there's a greatly expanded program now of providing Ukrainians with more surface-to-air missiles to give them the capabilities, in effect, to use, create their own no-fly zone by having greater capabilities to shoot down Russian airplanes and helicopters that fly into Ukrainian airspace.
You mentioned where Putin is at and what Vladimir Putin is putting on the table in the negotiations that are underway at the moment, and the big ask that they've put down on the table. Impossible, really, for Ukraine to give in to what they're asking for. How do you see those negotiations progressing? And do you think there's any hope from those negotiations?
You know, it's hard to tell because the sides have been talking, which is good. But if you look at what's coming out of Moscow, including the rant by President Putin 2 days ago, it doesn't seem like he's very much invested in the idea of negotiations. But there's some really tough questions. President Zelensky has indicated several times over the past 10 days that he's prepared to consider neutrality and perhaps drop NATO's bid for membership in NATO. But he wants security guarantees, and we don't yet understand what those mean. And the question is, how does Russia guarantee Ukraine's security in any kind of a credible way when in 1994, and I know about this because I helped negotiate it from the American side, is Russia, along with the United States and Britain, committed to respect Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity and committed not to use force against Ukraine or threaten to use force against Ukraine. And that was a key element to get Ukraine to give up what was then the world's third largest nuclear arsenal. And the Russians just shredded those commitments. So how do you come up with a credible security guarantee? That's going to be a challenge.
There's that. And then there's also, how does Putin save face, isn't there? You know, what does he have to get here that he could walk away and be able to sell his actions to his people?
Well, the one advantage that Putin and the Kremlin have is they pretty much control the information space within Russia. So any outcome they can probably portray in some way as a victory. And quite frankly, it's in the West and the Ukrainians that they want to declare victory at home. If that's a way to get him out, you know, we shouldn't care about that. But there are other things. I mean, the West was prepared. The United States and NATO were prepared to offer Russian negotiations on arms control measures, risk reduction steps, transparency measures that would have made a real contribution to European security, including the Russian security. The Russians weren't interested back in January, but that could be part of the effort where the Russians claim, well, we have these negotiations now to enhance our security. And if they got some kind of neutrality agreement, you know, they could put together something that they could package as a victory. But the problem for the Kremlin and the problem for Mr. Putin is the longer this war goes on, the harder it's going to be for him to leave in a way that he can claim victory.
All right, really interesting analysis, and thank you very much for joining us this evening. That's U.S. Ambassador, former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer. We'll take a break.